I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Later today, Move Over iPod. The Arcos is here. Wired Test Magazine is out with the best gadgets for 2008. We'll have them. But first, it looks like people were already lined up to buy them. On this day after Thanksgiving, the start of a closely watched holiday shopping period, to get customers spending early, many stores opened their doors in the dark. JCPenney at 4 a.m., Walmart at 5, and they offered steep discounts. But will it work? Chief Economist Mark Zandi of MoodysEconomy.com joins us. And Mark, I'm sure you saw these pictures as well. There were shoppers at a Target in South Carolina at 5 a.m. They look pretty enthusiastic, but what's the truth about consumer enthusiasm?
I think consumers are generally nervous and more cautious. I think it'll be an okay Christmas, but certainly not as good as Christmas past, not like last year or the year before, or even the year before that. It may vary quite a bit across the country. Certain parts of the country are now struggling very significantly. California, Nevada, Arizona, Florida, parts of the industrial Midwest centered around Detroit are arguably in recession. Employment's falling, unemployment's rising. It's going to be a very tough Christmas for retailers and consumers in that part of the country. Other parts of the country, Texas, the Carolinas, Pacific Northwest, not so bad.
By the way, I understand the cluster around Detroit, but why California?
The housing market's evaporating, and it's taking the job market with it. There's many jobs tied up in mortgage finance, construction, realtors, brokers, landscapers. People work at Home Depot and Lowe's. So the job market is crumbling under the weight of the falling housing market.
Other analysts are saying that they expect sales gains to be the weakest in 5 years. What's behind that?
A confluence of factors. The job market is weakening. Stock market is up, down, all around, but going nowhere fast, hasn't moved anywhere over the past 6 months. We've seen the housing market evaporate. House prices are falling in over half the country, and that's certainly a weight. And then finally, and now most importantly, energy and gasoline prices. We're looking at gasoline prices rising very rapidly, close to record highs, and that's going to be a problem.
So it's the usual suspects, and we know that especially with the housing market going down, people, and especially young people who might be the bigger consumers, you know, buying their first furniture and stuff, with the value of their home going down, they're not borrowing against their home to go out and shop.
Yeah, that's right. There's just a lot fewer home sales, and therefore people aren't going out and buying the things to put into their new homes. And existing homeowners just can't borrow as aggressively against their home, fewer home equity lines of credit, less cash out refi. So there's less cash to spend on things, and that's also crimping spending.
Yeah. Well, you know, this day, they call it Black Friday, is supposed to be one of the busiest days of the season, but we understand that the weekend only accounts for about 10% of overall holiday sales. So, you know, remind us, how did this come to be a day of such importance if it's really such a low sales weekend?
Well, I think the day, in the context of all the other sales days, it's still a big day. Perhaps not as big as it was in years past, but still it's very important. And it sets the tone for the entire Christmas season. So if it's a really great day, probably means it'll be a pretty good Christmas season. If it's an okay day, then it means this season will be okay.
We know that a lot of the consumers that have been lining up, some since midnight, to go to Best Buys and Walmarts and Targets are doing so because of these huge sales that have been put on this day. As an analyst, is that a good idea for consumers? Are those really the best buys?
I think retailers are going to be very aggressive as the season progresses. If it starts shaping up to be a relatively weak one, as I would anticipate, those sales and discounts should get even better. So it might make sense to be patient because you'll probably get a good deal today, but you'll probably get an even better deal as we approach Christmas.
We're reading, for instance, there's no new must-have item. We're going to, as I mentioned, talk about the things that are on the horizon in 2008, but there's no iPod that everyone feels they must have. Many people already have it. How does that affect today?
Yeah, there is no thing that people must have. Also, there's a lot of nervousness about the various toys we're importing from China and other parts of the world. So it is, I think, weighing on consumer psychology and sentiment. So not only is income soft and house prices down and gas prices up, but there's just nothing out there lighting the fire of consumer imaginations, and I think that's also going to weigh on Christmas.
By the way, we read that one sales trend, and I have no idea what it means, is that at clothing stores, dresses have been a stronger seller than in the past. Do you have any sense of what that means?
You know, I don't. Demographics do play a role. The age composition of the population is shifting. We've got a lot of 20-somethings, and perhaps they're
buying dresses.
Buying dresses, yeah.
Chief Economist Mark Zandi from Moody'sEconomy.com. Mark, happy Thanksgiving, and thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Robin.
And one other quick note on the economy. Higher gas prices, the ones that Mark just spoke of, will apparently also mean costlier Christmas trees this holiday season. The Associated Press reports that the manager of the biggest Christmas tree auction in the country in Pennsylvania says fuel costs drove prices up about 10% over last year for the nearly 40,000 trees sold this past Tuesday at auction. On this day after Thanksgiving, a reflection on another bird, the pigeon. Perhaps the one bird that gets less respect than the turkey. Here's comic singer-songwriter Tom Lehrer on that subject.
All the world seems in tune on a spring afternoon when we're poisoning pigeons in the park. Every Sunday you'll see my sweetheart and me as we poison the pigeons in the park.
Tom Lehrer is not alone. There are people who hate pigeons. Woody Allen famously called them rats with wings, and that stuck. But did you know that the Holy Spirit is said to have visited the Virgin Mary in the form of a pigeon? That Darwin studied pigeons when he formulated his theory of evolution? Carrier pigeons saved thousands of lives during both world wars. One, Cher Ami, was awarded the French Croix de Guerre. Her stuffed and tattered body is on display at the Smithsonian. Pigeons mate for life, delivered the results of the first Olympics, brought news of Napoleon's defeat. A mere pound and a half of flesh and feather, they can fly over 500 miles in a single day, and scientists still don't know how they do it. Author Andrew Bleckman spent a year with people who race pigeons, fly them, hunt them, eat them, frantically protect them. He shared what he found in the book Pigeons, the fascinating saga of the world's most revered and reviled bird. It's now out in paperback. When we first spoke with Andrew earlier this year, we asked him, first of all, why pigeons?
I tell people, I start with a tuna sandwich, honestly.
Okay.
I was at a bodega ordering a tuna sandwich, and this guy told me about his pigeons, about his brother, his and his brother's pigeons. And he started telling me that they race. And I was like, race? I go, you talking about the pigeons in the park? He goes, well, my pigeons are thoroughbreds. I mean, come on, we're talking about a pigeon here. So the next day I went out to see his birds, and you should have seen them running around the roof like they were soccer coaches in athletic costumes with whistles around their necks, like barking orders at their birds, brewing concoctions, special teas with different Chinese herbs in them, measuring out how many carbs to proteins they're going to eat that night.
This is Orlando and his friend Chester. Through them, you learn of these clubs where people pit their pigeons against each other in these races and love their pigeons. I want you to share a little with us of a scene where you are on the roof. Throughout the book, Orlando and Chester and others are preparing for this big race, the main event. But this is one point where you're up on the roof with them, and their birds, I think at this point, have been sent out?
Yes, 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 the night before.
Okay.
And now they're waiting for them to come back. Okay. This is the moment of truth.
Okay.
The waiting is killing Chester. He walks around the roof and talks excitedly about the sport. It's like a bug inside you, and you can't get it out. You got to be dedicated. I don't eat until my birds eat. I feed them a lot of carbs last night. Chester pauses mid-sentence and points at a black dot 50 yards away. There she is, he shouts. My bird, I knew it, I knew it. After navigating 500 miles home, the bird looks skinny and exhausted, as if she had lost some of her breast meat. Her mouth is open, gasping for water and air. But she's reluctant to enter the loft where Chester can grab her race band and timestamp it with the clock. She sits on top of the coop, staring warily at the man with the giant fly swatters. 5 precious minutes pass before she finally hits the landing board and enters the coop.
Now, animal activists make an appearance throughout your book for different reasons that we'll discuss.
The pro-pigeon underground.
They are, and there are people who, you know, are very much against this pigeon racing.
Yeah, there are some, but let me make clear, I'm not a bird person. You know, I just learned about, like, the birds in my backyard while writing this book, so I started to take an interest all of a sudden.
And what you got to know as you knew people like Orlando and Chester racing the pigeons is that these are, you know, tough guys living in Brooklyn, I think it was, but they loved their pigeons.
You know, I always think of Mike Tyson when I think of these guys. Mike Tyson is obviously a very tough guy. came from a brutal neighborhood. And for him, the only sense of freedom or liberation he had was to go on his roof and let his pigeons out. And the best part, unlike everyone else in his life, they always returned. And they didn't want anything from him.
Let's talk a little bit about pigeons. When you're talking about pigeons, is the word interchangeable with doves?
It is, actually. Pigeon, basically, what is a pigeon? A pigeon is a dove. Pigeon is just pigeon. It's French for dove. And actually, when Picasso was painting doves, he was actually painting pigeons. His father was a pigeon fancier, and he named his daughter Paloma, which is just Spanish for pigeon, which is French for dove.
And you went to a show where people were purchasing pigeons, and they have curlicues, and there are pigeons that do somersaults constantly. There's a million different kinds.
I went to a pigeon beauty pageant.
That's what it was, actually.
And it was certainly unusual. There are hundreds of breeds of pigeons, but they're all the same bird. In fact, that's why Darwin used them to prove his theory of evolution. On the Origin of Species, the first 60 pages is nothing but pigeons. Mm-hmm. In fact, when he turned in his book to his publisher said, you know, nice book, but what do you say we just lose everything but the pigeon chapter and we'll just expand on that?
You went to some sort of an awards dinner in London.
Yes, for pigeons, for veteran pigeons.
An award dinner for veteran pigeons. And, you know, a veteran got up and spoke of a pigeon who had saved his life.
And there were tears.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, for example, Cher Ami, it's the story of the Lost Battalion. It was World War I. It was all of our boys stuck behind enemy lines, and they were being decimated not only by the Germans, but also by our own artillery, friendly fire. They had no way to communicate to headquarters. They had three birds. They would take birds in baskets with them into the trenches. And the first two were shot down with messages. They had one bird. We're talking about 500 men, our boys. Their lives were dependent on 1 pound of flesh and feathers getting a message back to headquarters to please rescue them. And this bird, Cher Ami, was actually shot at and gassed. It flew through a barrage of fire and actually plummeted to earth. It somehow, pluck, valor, what have you, was able to flap its wings again, gain some altitude, and get out of gunshot range. 25 minutes later, it landed at headquarters. It was missing an eye. Its breastbone had been ripped open. Mm-hmm. And the message was dangling from tendons. That was what was left of his leg. And those boys were saved. And I'm telling you, if just think about if this were Iraq. If those were your kids, I think you'd think that bird was pretty special.
Right.
And that bird actually received medals from the French, from the British, and from the Americans. And we're talking serious medals. Not only that, but it was brought back to the United States on a troop carrier and was given General Pershing's personal berth. And then arrived, and then it was received a hero's welcome. Yeah. Now, look how far we've come.
Yes, although to many, the pigeon is now the bird that, frankly, you know, messes your car. When we come back, the downside of being a pigeon, people shoot them, eat them, falsely think they spread disease. Andrew Bleckman's book is Pigeons, the Fascinating Saga of the World's Most Revered and Reviled Bird. We'll have more. And later today, a new trend to read old diaries and love letters from the stage. Back after a quick break here and now. And we're back with more of our conversation with author Andrew Bleckman on pigeons, the much-loved, sometimes reviled bird. Before the break, we were speaking of pigeons as heroic messengers and all the tributes they received. People do love pigeons. Speaking of which, we need to warn fellow animal lovers. Some of what you're about to hear is upsetting because Andrew also spoke with people who eat pigeons, shoot them. He went to a live pigeon shoot in Pennsylvania, and we asked him, is it legal to hold a live pigeon shoot?
Let me make this very clear to all your listeners. Unfortunately, it is legal to shoot thousands of live pigeons for target practice.
Explain how it works. It's very secretive. It was very difficult for you to get into one of these.
I think I'm the only person that ever has.
Well, and how does it work?
Basically, there's five baskets or so. Actually, maybe there's nine. And you don't know which one's going to open. And then a bird just catapults out, and you have to target it. There were so many things about it that were just so tragic. If you shoot the bird, but it lands outside of a prescribed circle, it doesn't count. The point doesn't count.
So but it's the birds, a dead bird, but...
Or actually, the Humane Society actually did a study on it. 75% of them actually don't die right away, but they suffer for either hours on end, or they have trapper boys, which are like 8 to 12-year-olds, who run out there, pick up the birds in between shootings, and then twist their necks or throw them in. They generally stuff them into trash bags where they all suffocate together.
Well, as you write, thankfully, a lot of these live pigeon shoots have converted to clay pigeon shoots. But you tried it and were slightly ashamed of yourself, not because you missed the pigeon, but because you got pulled in.
Yeah, I got pulled in. There's something very primal about holding a warm gun. I'm not a gun person. This was my first time shooting a shotgun. Right. And the competitive spirit overtook me, and then I was shocked by it. And then I was actually revulsed afterwards as I walked back to my car. And there were skewered pigeons all over the place, just like limping on one foot, blood coming out of their beaks, wings askew. And we're talking thousands of pigeons.
Okay. Well, and then you meet a whole underground of people, as you say, the pro-pigeon movement, people trying to protect pigeons, people sneaking around New York City. there's a pigeon internet chat site or something?
Oh, there's all sorts of pigeons. I mean, yeah, there's a listserv, and those are the rescue ones. And then there's the pro-pigeon underground. They all have code names. They keep you on camera, video camera, whenever you meet with them. And they run around trying to catch poachers on the streets of a lot of major cities, who then bring them to rural gun clubs to shoot.
Another guy trying to protect the birds, David Roth of Arizona, who sort of lives in a bird cage. His whole house has this become a bird cage because he lets his rescued pigeons just wander freely and do what pigeons do. But he has saved pigeons from poisoning.
David Roth, I call him probably the sanest crazy person I've ever met. I found him utterly charming. He looks like Jerry Garcia, like circa 1972 from like the Europe 72 tour. And he seems awfully normal until you go into his house and it's covered in like a foot of guano.
Yeah, not good.
And pigeons attract an obsessive group of people.
Why do you think that is, though? What is it about the pigeon? It's not a crow. I mean, what is it about the
pigeon? It's the only animal I know that spans both sides of the spectrum. I mean, people love puppies and kitty cats, right? They don't like rats or snakes for the most part. But pigeons, it's like a foil on human nature. They either love them or they hate them.
But why the love?
Why the love? Because they're wonderful creatures.
Yeah. And they are loving.
Yeah, their biggest crime is that they're gregarious and they like us.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're incredibly gentle. I mean, what other creature would you let your 2-year-old romp around with?
Yeah.
You know, wildlife-wise.
Well, and having said that, and having met all these people who just have these, you know, passionate love, they just love their pigeons. You eat one.
Yeah.
What were you thinking? Well, because there are people who breed pigeons for eating.
Yeah, actually, pigeon is one of the finest meats in the world. I hate to compare it to this, but it's often referred to as the milk-fed feel of the sky. Basically, what we're talking about is squab. There's such a dislike of pigeons, a revulsion of them, that you would never see pigeon on the menu. Although in the colonial times, pigeon pot pie was one of the most popular things to make.
How they've survived all of this, I don't know, but keep going. Keep going. So you eat one.
So I do eat one, and unfortunately, this was right after a tour of a brutal slaughterhouse. And I was basically asked by a very hospitable, the owner who was giving me the whole tour, oh, have some. And it was the last thing I actually felt like doing at the time. But it was delicious. And I reached for another bite.
And for the second time, you're ashamed.
I want to say I'm ashamed of that one.
Well, because we have in the back of our mind Orlando and the pigeons that he loves, and Chester and the pigeons that they love. We're not going to give away the ending, but the main event, the big race, does happen at the ending. We've spoken about, you know, why people might love the pigeons, but why they hate them, you know,
yeah.
That they congregate in cities, that, you know, they do make a mess, they do what pigeons do. But is it true? I mean, are they flying rats? Do they spread disease?
No, and no.
I only asked two, but go
yeah,
ahead.
No
yeah,
and yeah. No.
Right, right.
No, they are not flying rats. The only thing they have in common with rats is they're both vertebrates. They don't carry any more diseases than you or I do. They're not particularly dirty. Don't forget, they live off the food we drop. They're basically our street cleaners. The reality is this. People don't have a problem with pigeons. They have a problem with too many pigeons. Mm-hmm. And wildlife, let's face it, wildlife is inconvenient. But does that mean that we have to poison it? It animates our lives. Our cities don't have much animation in that way, no, wildlife. All we really have are pigeons, squirrels, and sparrows.
And how do the carrier pigeons and the homing pigeons, how do they do that?
Well, the short answer is we don't know exactly. The long answer is it seems to be they have an internal compass that senses the Earth's magnetic field. And they have ultrasound hearing. They're able to hear wind over the Rockies from 2,000 miles away. Hmm. They're able to see ultraviolet light that gives them a sense of the curvature of the Earth. My favorite story is, you know, regardless of how they do it, they just do it. And my favorite story is Orlando, one of my characters. There's this race, and his best bird, Marty, is sent out. And Marty doesn't come home. It's a 300-mile race. Marty does not come home. And Orlando's, you know, it's one of his best birds. He figured, okay, a hawk ate her. Mm. Well, 2 weeks later, he's leaving his house. He's at the front door. He looks down at the stoop, and there's Marty with a broken wing. She had walked home.
Oh, you're killing me. You're killing me.
Who'd have thunk? I'm telling you, they're wonderful creatures. I mean, they really are.
That's author Andrew Bleckman. His book, Pigeons, The Fascinating Saga of the World's Most Revered and Reviled Bird, is now out in paperback. I love that bird. Next week on Here and Now, we'll ask a healthcare policy expert, what exactly are the presidential candidates proposing? Also, a visit with Nick Hornby, that's next week. Still ahead today, Wired's best gadgets after the news Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and as we've been hearing all day, soaring oil prices, a meltdown in the housing market, and plunging consumer confidence is not a recipe for a brisk holiday shopping season. But that hasn't dampened the enthusiasm of product testers at Wired magazine. Every year, they bring thousands of new products into the lab to find the best of test in cell phones, computers, cameras, and other gadgets. And joining us from San Francisco is Mark McCluskey. He's editor of Wired Test magazine. He talked to us last year. So welcome back, Mark.
Thanks for having me back. It's great to talk to you guys again.
This is a special edition of Wired Magazine. Before we dive in, what do you, across the board, think is the biggest story this year in terms of new gadgets?
I think the biggest story this year is really sort of the increasing cheapening of HDTVs. Mm. You know, the prices just are plummeting on these really big, beautiful screens.
Well, when you say plummet, from what to what?
A big 32-inch screen, which is good for a bedroom, that sort of thing, for $650, $700. And that the sort of 42-inch screen, which is kind of the benchmark living room screen, is more in the $1,000 to $1,500 range. That's down $600, $700, $800 from last year.
Okay, let's talk about which one you recommend.
Our favorite is a little bit more expensive because it's a little larger. It's the Aliva 747i, and it's a $2,500 set. It's also a 47-inch LCD screen.
You know, this is one of those items. I mean, you're either in the market for something like this or you're not. And as you write in describing the Aliva 747i, you know those kids of yours, the ones you're always bragging about? This is better. So you're appealing to real, you know, people who really like gadgets.
Definitely, it's an investment. You have to love your television. It's a spectacular-looking screen. It's very clear and bright, and its video processing is very good, which means that no matter what sort of signal you throw at it, be it, you know, satellite TV or cable TV or a game system or a DVD player, all of them look terrific. It's very smart at handling different video inputs.
Well, let's talk about, you know, what you watch on television. There's, we understand, a format war brewing between Blu-ray and HD DVDs. These are the next generation DVDs.
Just what we need, another format war, right? You may remember VHS versus Betamax. That's the most famous format war. That there were these two competing technologies, you know, different companies lined up behind different ones, and eventually VHS won. We have a somewhat similar situation now. Blu-ray is primarily led by Sony and their partners. HD DVD is really being driven by Toshiba and their partners. To play these new discs, you are going to need a new player, either a Blu-ray player, and the most famous of those right now is the PlayStation 3 video game system actually will also function as a Blu-ray player, or you need to get an HD DVD player. Now, there is some good news here, and that is that either of them will play all of your old DVDs, so you don't have a situation where you're going to have to throw out everything you already own.
I'm still transferring my videotapes, so
exactly.
To DVDs.
You know, you're still, you know, I still have a box of cassettes somewhere that I have nothing to play them on now. So, If I had to place a bet, I would bet on Blu-ray becoming the dominant format here. It's a little more advanced technology, and they generally have more of the movie studios supporting Blu-ray than HD DVD, and that's obviously a big deal because, you know, where else are you going to get the content? I think most importantly, I mentioned the PlayStation 3. You know, that's kind of a Trojan horse that Sony includes the Blu-ray player in a video game system, but then you have a Blu-ray player and are going to buy Blu-ray discs and rent Blu-ray discs.
Right, so they've gotten it out into the marketplace. Well, you spoke of content. There's a new movie download service called Vudu, V-U-D-U. Tell us about that.
It's a little box. It's a little black box because, you know, that's what you really want is another box by your TV.
On the pyramid of boxes.
Yeah, you know, everybody has been really aching for another box. But this one, actually, it's really cool. And what it is, it's a movie download service. You pay $400 for the box and hook it up to the internet. And then movies are between $1 and $4. And what separates the Vudu is, first of all, there are 5,000 movies on it. The other thing is how they manage the downloads. You pick a movie and it starts playing immediately, and it downloads the rest of it in the background. What it does is it's got little chunks of the movie on all of the Vudu boxes all around the world and on their network. And so as you ask it to start downloading a movie, it goes to all of these other peers all around the world and starts pulling in those sections. It's a smart way to move really huge files because these video files are very massive, you know, without overburdening one particular server. You spread the load across a lot of servers.
Because if you wanted to get one film downloaded, you might be there a while. But it'll start you watching on a piece and then go around the world and get all the other pieces and assemble it while you're watching.
Exactly.
Well, your magazine concludes that the biggest innovation of the year is the iPhone. We're not going to spend too much time on that because we have spent a lot of time on the iPhone. But what about the MP3 player that Apple first launched to Superstar and with its iPod? What's new on that front?
Yeah, there are a couple of things. One is there's the iPod Touch, which is basically the iPhone without the phone. It has internet connectivity via Wi-Fi, like the iPhone, so you can surf the web. You can even buy songs online. It's beautiful. It's brilliant. For me, given the price difference, which isn't that great, it's about $100 between the iPod Touch and the iPhone at this point. I think that I would probably spend the extra $100 and eliminate, you know, to get the iPhone and eliminate one gadget from my pockets.
But we understand that your new favorite portable media player, you know, we talk about the iPod Touch and the iPod and the iPhone. You like something called the Arcos 605 Wi-Fi. What is this?
It's a media player. So it plays movies, it displays your photos on this big screen, it plays music, you know, it does all of the things that an iPod Touch or even an iPod now, you know, the regular iPod Classic will play movies and show pictures and stuff. But it ups the size of the screen enough that it's really a terrific experience. You know, watching a TV show on a small 2-inch iPod screen can feel, you know, I'm not a huge fan of that experience. It's sort of like, oh, look, that smear over there looks kind of like my favorite character on this TV show.
As your tester writes, it may persuade you that every last byte of your digital life belongs on one of these Arcos portable media
player. Yeah, it's a media player.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it's sort of expanding out from the idea of just a music machine to something that really can show off all of your digital content, be it music, videos, photos. And it even has Wi-Fi built in so you can surf the web on it. It's a pretty decent little web surfing machine as well.
Okay. Well, I'm still working on programming my cell phone. So these are your picks. How did you do the testing?
So, I mean, Wired Test is really the result of over half a year and thousands of person hours of work. So there's a staff of 6 or 7 editors and an army of a couple dozen freelancers, and you know, we get all the products in, we do our testing on them. Our goal is to try and take this marketplace, which is so massive, there are 20,000 consumer electronics products introduced in the U.S. each year, and whittle it down to, you know, 300 that you should care about.
Of all the things that you tested, was there one you'd want to keep?
Is there one I'd want to keep? You know, the TVs are definitely up there. You know, when you get one of these big old TVs in your living room, even despite your wife's dismay. But also the high-def video cameras. I've got a 2-year-old daughter, and the high-def video cameras that we had in this year, they're spectacular. The sort of quality that a couple of years ago was a $30,000 professional camera, and now it's about $1,000.
Which one does the magazine recommend?
Canon's camera this year, the HV10, is just a great piece of machinery. Just look at it and nod and smile and be like, yes, that's a lovely, lovely job you did.
Mark McCluskey, editor of Wired Test, a look at the world's best gadgets. Mark, thanks so much for telling us about them.
You're welcome.
And quick look ahead. Today, Saudi Arabia announced it will attend Monday's peace conference in Annapolis, but not allow photo ops with handshakes with Israeli officials. We'll have a report. Also, do you believe in God? Next week, we'll hear how cultural heavyweights answered that question. You're listening to Here Now. Well, it's time now for your letters and our correction. Let's do that first, because sometimes we make mistakes, but recently I made a doozy. On Veterans Day, I shared some personal thoughts about homeless veterans, including my own granddad back in the 50s. Many of you wrote with appreciation, thank you. But Adam Stanhope of Kingston, Massachusetts asked, "You said half of America's 24 million veterans were homeless at some point last year. Is that true?" No, I misread my own copy. Half a million of America's 24 million vets were homeless. I'm so sorry. You can hear the corrected essay at our website. Let's see. We spoke recently with Don Coover, a rancher who's raising and selling cloned animals. He defends selling cloned meat without labeling it as such by saying he's just trying to meet American demand, and cloning the very best animal provides the very best meat. Well, Martin Anderson of Cloverdale, Oregon, wrote to say, "We've been tampering with nature for a while." He writes, "All the apples you eat are from clone cuttings, as are all the flowers you buy, maybe oranges too. And those tomatoes you eat might be from combining seeds to get fruit that's hard enough to not break when dropped from 3 or 4 feet." But many of you were appalled at the idea of cloned meat in the marketplace. And Richard Karnatz of Texarkana, Texas, adds, "I think the major problem with cloning animals will be the same problem Henry Ford had in Brazil with his Fordlandia, the rubber tree farm he set up in the Brazilian rainforest with only one variety of rubber tree. The effect being, when a single disease struck, it decimated the trees and his dreams. My fear is that unless each farmer has a large genetic diversity of these clones, a single virus or microbe could wipe out an entire stockyard." Well, we also spoke recently with Washington University professor David Barish about displaced aggression. He said lab tests show animals actually become physically healthier if they take out their pain and anger on other animals, that there are evolutionary reasons why people, families, whole countries pick a scapegoat, but that it's also something we can stop. Well, Eva Webster of Brighton, Massachusetts, had this comment.
"I'm just calling to express my deep appreciation for the program on scapegoating. This is the kind of stuff that should be taught in schools. It's tremendously important that you do programs like this."
Thank you, Eva. Well, last week we also spoke with a Christian homeschooler in Iowa. He said he was looking for a presidential candidate who would give him a tax break for homeschooling because his property taxes were going to public schools he wasn't using. Well, first of all, many of you wrote to point out not all homeschoolers are Christian. But Kate Murphy of Huntersville, North Carolina, also objected to his reasoning on tax breaks. She writes, "In the past year, I managed to stay out of jail and the emergency room and keep my house from burning down. However, I don't expect a tax credit for my share of the public funding that runs police, fire, and emergency departments. That's simply not the way our country works." A couple of final thoughts. We spoke this week about the coffee gender gap, a Middlebury College study that showed that women's coffee orders came 20 seconds later than men's did. Steve Hawkins of Vancouver, Washington writes, "A possible explanation for women's longer wait times is that the servers know that women have a longer life expectancy than men, thus they can spare the 20 seconds. All right. And finally, David Bates of Downingtown, Pennsylvania, called with this thought on our piece about Boston accents.
"I can't believe you folks went through that whole delightful feature on Boston accents without mentioning two fellows from your own building who are well known all over the country, Bob and Ray of Car Talk."
"Bob and Ray, I've been listening to you since 1929.
Wait a minute. Bob and Ray, the great comedy duo of the 50s and 60s? They are from New England.
Come possibile? Questi due gemmi, click and clack.
No, of course, he meant Tom and Ray, our ambassadors to the world. And aren't we proud?
Crazy guys, click and clack. What are they doing here?
As always, send us your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org, or give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. When we come back, high school diaries hit the stage in the show Mortified, Here and Now. Thanksgiving week is also homecoming, when people who last crossed paths in high school bump into each other at their old stomping grounds, swap stories about the good old days. Recently, they've been doing this on stage, reading from old high school diaries, love letters, and poems.
The poem is entitled, Un amor de no correspondida. You wait for the skater outside the classroom, our classroom. One look and I'm not there anymore. You make me disappear. Don't touch her by your locker. I don't want to disintegrate. I'm about to disintegrate.
You're the bomb, girl. And even though that sounds cheesy and homeboy, it's the utter truth. You are the bomb. The bomb that makes my heart explode.
It's part of a nationwide show called Mortified, ordinary people sharing their notes from adolescence with a room full of strangers. Here now's Kevin Sullivan, first caught the show in Boston last year.
I guess I was writing this to Pierre Cardin, just to show my age. Dear Pierre, your new collection is divine. I love what you're doing and wish you all the best. It's been 2 years now, and I think we should merge. Why not?
Cheryl Caligari is channeling her tween alter ego, Natasha, a pint-sized power broker modeled after Dynasty diva Alexis Carrington. As a kid, Cheryl played out her boardroom fantasies by typing letters to imaginary clients. Now she's sharing those memories with about 200 strangers at the Paradise Lounge in Boston.
Last year, you know, my Chanel No. 5 was an estimated $25,000 success. Aim high. Pierre Cardin is a smash, and so is my new cosmetics collection. Everyone is talking about it. Let's have dinner at the Chateau, and we can discuss the details. Let me know, and I'll have the lawyers draw up the contracts immediately. Yours truly, Natasha.
We're devoted to one very unique thing, which is creating sort of a comic excavation of teen angst artifacts. That's letters, lyrics, journals, home movies and more, and letting their original authors share them with total strangers. And somehow they agree to do it.
That's Mortified creator Dave Nadelberg, a 30-something hipster from Los Angeles who came up with Mortified after finding some old high school love poems that failed to impress. Now, he's helping others exploit their adolescent angst on stage with Mortified shows in 10 cities.
One of the fun things is getting to take ordinary people, whether it's architects or advertising execs, soccer moms, and kind of letting them get their rock star kicks on stage for a night.
Ordinary people like Sharon Jeldon. According to the Mortified program, she dreamed of becoming a writer and ended up, quote, pregnant again. That kind of self-deprecating humor is a Mortified must. Here's Sharon.
Cheap Jew is about the worst thing to be called in the entire world. The other worst thing in the entire world to be called is rich Jew. I'm walking a very fine line here. Bye, Sharon. Dear Diary, I made a big, giant mistake. I drove Dad's car to school today. In social studies, in front of the whole class, Mr. Johann goes, Miss Katz, I saw your car. Very nice. I wish I could have a Volvo someday, too. Oh, my God. I'm, like, totally freaking out. Now I'm a rich Jew.
Mortified is like stumbling through a soundtrack for the 1980s and 90s and then admitting you actually like the songs. Tunes like this Peter Gabriel favorite, Come Talk to Me, bookend each performance. It's easy to relate to the performers because, unfortunately, we've all been there.
These are all my friends from around Boston.
Rebecca Tuck is a 35-year-old mother of three from Natick, Massachusetts. This will be her first time on stage.
Where's the husband? Uh-oh. Now, did you guys know each other in high school?
No, we didn't.
Oh, boy. Okay, husband. Excuse me. She just described to me some of these diary entries, and she said she was kind of boy crazy.
You don't have to say kind of. She was all over the boys in seventh grade. She wouldn't have liked me in seventh grade.
Why is that?
I think I had one girl date me for maybe 5 minutes in seventh grade. She had about 50 boyfriends in seventh grade.
So what do you think of her coming out here on stage and sort of bearing her seventh grade soul?
I'm glad we're doing her seventh grade diary. I've heard some of the later entries in her diary. I would be mortified.
Dear Diary, Cindy likes Ben. I just like him as a friend. I found out that loving is not just good looks, but friendship.
On stage, Rebecca reads from a weathered, palm-sized diary. It looks like it spent years abandoned at the bottom of a box in an attic somewhere. Her husband, Ben, probably wishes it had stayed there.
Dear Diary, I'm confused. I think I'm really in love with Billy, but today I was talking to Mark and he said John wants to go out with me. Then we started laughing and he asked me if I'd go out with him. Then he said, you'd never go out with me, even if you weren't going out with Billy. And I said, who said? Then he asked me, well, would you? And I thought a minute, then I answered yes. After that, he told me, don't be surprised if Billy suddenly gets murdered. And this is the last journal entry. It's June 27th, 1985. Dear Diary, help. My mom read my diary.
That music intros 25-year-old Chuck Young. At 16, he wooed his first girlfriend with notes that were part Dr. Dre, part Celine Dion.
When I saw you, I was all, damn, and you were all, right? And I was all, right on, sweetie, and so on and so forth. I'm glad you liked the kiss. I liked it too. If I kissed you all of the times I wanted to, all hell would break loose. Stay true, sweetheart, and keep it real. Love, gangsta.
I guess that's a mortified generation for you. But will it last? After all, who writes notes in class anymore when there's email, text messaging, and online journals on websites like MySpace? Here's Chuck.
I can go and look at someone I don't even know and look at their journal and see how kind of pathetic their life has become. So yeah, I think we probably are, you know. We're almost the last generation that can kind of get away with this, I'd say, you know?
And based on this last entry, maybe that's for the best.
I'm in love with you. So in love. You are my rose. Rose as in a beautiful flower, and rose as in Rose from Titanic. And hopefully someday I can be good enough to be your Jack. Be able to save you in every way possible. And she responds, you are my Jack. You already did save me. Oh, yeah, I have it.
Isn't that lovely? And somehow so humiliating at the same time. Our story on the show Mortified was produced by Kevin Sullivan, and to his mortification, his wife Lucia was so inspired that she dragged out her old diaries and hit the stage. So here is Lucia Sullivan reflecting on her sixth grade crush on classmate Ben Affleck. Yes, the kid two rows over grew up to be actor Ben Affleck.
I don't know Devin, but I'm sure she doesn't deserve Ben like I do. I want him, need him, deserve him. I shouldn't flirt with Ben if he's going out with Devin. If he's not, he's mine. Jordache jeans and all. What could an eighth grader want with Ben? If she hurts him, I'll kill her.
To find out if there's a Mortified show in your area, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Have a wonderful weekend, and join us again, Here and Now.
I could stay awake just to hear you breathing.
You can listen to Here and Now live each weekday at noon Eastern Time by going to WBUR.org and clicking on the Listen Live button. You can also find us each weekday at noon Eastern on XM Radio Channel 133.